The Crusades and Jihad. We looked a few weeks ago on understanding the Crusades, what led up to the Crusades. Frontline Fellowship is a mission to persecute church. For 29 years, we've been working on seeking to win Africa for Christ. Sudan, which is firmly in the Muslim world in the 1040 window, part of the Middle East, has been a major part of our missions activities. We have teams there right now. I've flown into Sudan on multiple occasions and led 27 different missions to Sudan. And in the last 15 years, Frontline Fellowship delivered over 300,000 Bibles and Christian books in 24 languages into 14 different regions of Sudan, including the Nuba Mountains, way behind enemy lines, giving leadership training, doing ministry in areas where the church has been bombed, where the villages have been scorched earth, where Christians have been fighting a war of survival against Muslim aggressors. And so, to us, the subject of jihad is not of academic interest. It's actually a matter of life and death, and many people today are facing jihad. The Crusades may have ended 700 years ago, but jihad has not ended, and in fact is increasing. So, from the perspective of our mission, I've been challenged to study a whole lot more on the subject of jihad and the Crusades, especially as the Crusades are thrown at us so many times, is something we meant to apologize for. So, tonight, I thought, let us particularly look at the Crusades and jihad. My first encounter with jihad was in Sudan, and we've written a lot on that and spoken on the ministry there. But consider, first of all, the Crusades and colonialism. One of the first attacks and accusations against the Crusades is that it was colonialism, which is of course meant to be very, very bad. A common tactic used by many Muslims and their apologists is to accuse the West of having subjected Islamic nations to European colonialism. However, while Western colonialism and conquest of Muslim lands lasted for approximately 130 years, from the 1830s, when France started to take Algeria, through to the 1960s, when Britain left Aden, which is about the last of the European holdings over Muslim lands in the Middle East. But Muslim colonialization of European lands lasted for over 1,300 years. Many people forget that. Inspired by Muhammad's doctrine of jihad, the Saudi Arabians launched the first major colonial enterprise in history. Bear in mind, Arab comes from Saudi Arabia. Arabic is the language that's spoken in Saudi Arabia. The Arabic language has spread over the whole of the Middle East in areas where that wasn't the language. In Egypt, they spoke the Egyptian language, Copt. A Copt is an Egyptian. The Copts are now subjugated minority people in a country which once was their own. They've been swamped by foreign invaders, colonials, who are called Arabs. Arabs invaded and colonized Palestine in 633, Syria in 637, Jerusalem in 638, Egypt fell in 641, Persia beginning in 642, Spain in 711, Sicily in 827. Rome itself was conquered by jihadist armies in 846 and sacked. Now, these are just a few high points, or shall we say low points, of Islamic colonialism. The Muslims invaded and colonized Spain for 800 years. They got kicked out because they were foreign. 800 years didn't enable them to keep it. Portugal was colonized for 600 years. Greece for 500 years. Bulgaria was colonized by the Muslims for 500 years. Romania for 400 years. Serbia for 400 years, and they're still smarting under that. Sicily for 300 years. Hungary for 150 years. In fact, Italy and Sicily only got rid of the Arab colonials by hiring the Normans, the Vikings, to come and clear them out. The Muslims also struggled but failed to conquer Malta. That was the subject of one of our presentations a while ago, the Great Siege of Malta. The Muslims also struggled but failed to conquer Austria, and we'll be looking at the Great Siege and Battle of Vienna in future presentations. Muslims struggled but failed to conquer Italy. They conquered part of it, but the Vikings kicked them out. The Muslims struggled but failed to conquer Cyprus. They did take Cyprus, but they did get kicked out of Cyprus later. Muslims also struggled but failed to conquer Armenia, Poland, Georgia, Ukraine, and Russia. Bosnia, Kosovo and Albania, which were Muslim colonies for hundreds of years, continue to be places of intense violence and destabilization to this day. So anyone who wants to suggest that colonialism is something only the West has done, and the Arabs have never been involved in colonialism, obviously is just advertising its ignorance of history. What was Charles Martel fighting about at the Battle of Poitiers, Tours in France in 732? What were the Austrians fighting for in 1685 at the Great Siege and Battle of Vienna, when the Muslims were at the very heart of Europe seeking to conquer Vienna after they had taken Budapest in Hungary and taken 200,000 Christian slaves from Hungary as slaves to Constantinople? What was the Battle of Lepanto all about? Battle of Lepanto was exactly that, trying to protect Europe from Islamic invasion and colonialism. So one wonders why so much attention has been given to the Crusades, which lasted less than 200 years, rather than attention to Islamic Jihad, which has continued for 1,400 years. In some places, Jihad is intensifying at this time. The portrayal of the Crusades as imperialistic and colonial enterprises against peace-loving and tolerant Muslims who are just minding their own business in the Middle East, this is imaginative fiction. While the Encyclopedia Britannica could publish pages on the Crusades, it was silent on Jihad. You could not find anything in the Encyclopedia Britannica on Jihad. That's extraordinary, considering that predates and continues way past the Crusades. We've had 200 years of Crusades, finished 700 years ago, but 1,400 years of Jihad is apparently not worth a mention. Yet the Crusades are only a belated reaction to centuries of Islamic Jihad. A reaction. Seldom do modern historians or journalists recognize that the Crusaders were actually involved in a military response, which is a military response of Christian Europe to 5 centuries of Muslim aggression against Christian lands. The Crusades reacted to the systematic abuse and persecution of indigenous Christian populations in these lands which the Muslims had invaded. Professor Thomas Madden is one of the foremost authorities on the Crusades in the world today. He has written extensively on it, and he says the Crusades are quite possibly the most misunderstood event in European history. That's quite a statement, but it certainly is right up there, and one of the most misunderstood subjects with some of the most rubbish statements made on it. The Christians who took part in the 1999 Reconciliation Walk travelled to Turkey, Syria, Lebanon, Israel, asking for forgiveness for what their ancestors might have done during the Crusades some 900 years before. One of the more imbecilic abuses of Christian money in recent years. Had these individuals known their history, they would have realized that these were previously Christian lands which Muslims had invaded. Istanbul used to be called Constantinople. Turkey used to be called the Byzantine Empire. Muslims massacred tens of thousands of Christians. They desecrated and destroyed over 30,000 churches before the Crusades began. They demolished some of the most important churches in Christendom, like the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. This is just the rebuilt one. The original one was destroyed. Muslims seem obsessed with the Christian Crusades, but they've forgotten their own pervasive Jihad. Can't you just feel the tolerance? The unintended consequences of such well-meaning but obviously misinformed Christians apologizing for the Crusades is that it encourages Muslim radicalism. It shows them that Western Christians are weak and stupid. There is nothing Muslims respect more than strength. To this day, they still respect Richard the Lionheart. You mention him out there, all Muslims know about him. There's nothing they despise more than weakness. Christian apologies for the Crusades encourages the self-righteousness endemic in Islam. It encourages millions of Muslims in their hatred of the West in general and Christianity in particular. Notice that these reconciliation walks in 1999 didn't usher in a new era of peace and tolerance and goodwill. If anything, things got worse after that. And I don't think that's coincidental. There is no doubt that Islamic violence against Christians has exponentially increased throughout the Middle East and worldwide since 1999. So much for this reconciliation walk, which I'm sorry to say some of my missionary friends were involved in. Since then, we've had churches burned down in Nigeria. Christians murdered in Egypt, car bombs exploding in Alexandria outside churches, even at church services. Many hundreds of Egyptian Copts Christians murdered by Muslim radicals this year. Hundreds of Christians murdered this year in Iraq and in Afghanistan. In fact, the number of Christians in the Middle East has decreased dramatically from 15 million in the year 2000 to barely 13 million today. You can get that from Operation World, the 2000 edition compared to the 2010 edition. The only place in the world where the number of Christians has decreased in the last 10 years, the Middle East. And that's the birthplace of the Christian church. Ignorance of history makes one vulnerable to guilt manipulation and exploitation. Those who forget the lessons of history are doomed to repeat its mistakes. So, what are we to say about the Crusades? Back in 1999, while our mission was being bombed by the National Islamic Front government in Sudan, fellow missionaries were organizing reconciliation walks to the Middle East to apologize for the Crusades. At the time, our church service were under aerial and artillery bombardment by jihadists in Sudan, and it seemed rather bizarre to us. So I undertook a study of the Crusades and of jihad. And what I found was actually quite fascinating. The popular misconceptions about the Crusades were that they were aggressive wars of expansion fought by religious fanatics in order to evict Muslims from their homeland and to force conversions to Christianity. Power-hungry popes and absolutely paranoid knights and vicious Christians attacking these poor, innocent, minding their own business Muslims. But the historical record does not support these assertions. To quote a Muslim, Amin Maluf in The Crusades to Arab Eyes claims that the Crusaders' conquest of Jerusalem in 1099 was the starting point of a millennium of hostility between Islam and the West. Well, quite aside from the fact that that's 900 years ago, not a millennium, that wasn't the beginning at all. Another Islamic scholar, John Esposito, blames the Crusades for disrupting 5 centuries of peaceful coexistence, which had elapsed before political events and an imperial papal power play, led to centuries-long series of so-called holy wars that pitted Christendom against Islam and left an enduring legacy of mistrust and distrust. That no less an authority than Bill Clinton claimed that all the tensions in the Middle East began with the Crusades. But the question is, what preceded the Crusades? What came before it? The fact is, the Crusades only started after 5 centuries of Islamic jihad had conquered and annihilated or forcibly converted over 2/3 of what had formerly been the Christian world. Shortly after the Islamic conquest of Jerusalem in 638, Christian pilgrims were harassed and massacred. And early in the 8th century, 60 Christian pilgrims from Amerima were crucified. The Muslim governor of Caesarea seized a group of pilgrims from Iconium and had them all executed. Muslims extorted ransom money from pilgrims, threatened to ransack the most holy churches in Christendom, such as the Church of the Resurrection, if they didn't pay exorbitant jizah, taxes. This is some of the peaceful coexistence that was coming on before the Crusades. In the 8th century, a Muslim ruler banned all displays of the cross in Jerusalem. He also increased the penalty tax, jizah, to be forced on non-Muslims. He forbade Christians to engage in any religious instruction, even on their own children. In 772, the Caliph al-Mansur ordered the hands of all Christians and Jews in Jerusalem to be branded. In 789, Muslims beheaded a monk in Bethlehem, plundered the monastery, slaughtered many more Christians. In 923, a new wave of destruction of church was launched by Muslim rulers. In 937, Muslims went on a rampage in Jerusalem on Palm Sunday, plundering and destroying the Church of Calvary and the Church of the Resurrection. These are just some of the events. We'll just take a few highlights. Of course, this is indicative of the pattern. These were not the exceptions. In 1004, which is almost 100 years before the Crusades began, Fatima Khalifa Abu al-Mansur al-Hakim unleashed a violent wave of church burning and destruction and confiscation of Christian property, ferocious slaughter of both Christians and Jews. Over the next 10 years, 30 1,000 churches were destroyed in the Middle East. That's in 10 years. Vast numbers of believers were forcibly converted or killed. In 1009, Al-Hakim ordered that the most holy churches in Christendom, the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, and the Church of the Resurrection Jerusalem, be destroyed. He heaped humiliating and burdensome decrees upon Christians and Jews, forcing Christians to wear heavy cross around their necks and Jews to have blocks of wood in the shape of a calf around their necks. Ultimately, he ordered Christians and Jews to either accept Islam or flee his areas of control. Christians remained in a precarious position and under threat throughout the Middle East. When the Seljuk Turks swept throughout Jerusalem in 1077, they murdered over 3,000 people, including many Christians. It was at this point that the Christian emperor of Byzantium, Alexius I, appealed for help to the Western churches. And Pope Urban II issued the challenge to the Knights of Europe at the Council of Clermont in 1095, which all historians accept as the beginning of the Crusades. And these were his words at that historic occasion. The Turks and Arabs have attacked our brethren in the east and have conquered the territory of Romania. That's what they called the Greek Empire. As far as the shore of the Mediterranean and the Hellespont. And have occupied more and more of the lands of those Christians and have overcome them in 7 battles. They have killed and captured many and have destroyed the churches and devastated the empire. By that they mean Eastern Roman Empire. If you continue to permit them to continue thus for a while with impunity, the faithful of God will be much more widely attacked by them. On this account, I persuade all people of whatever rank, foot soldiers and knights, poor and rich, to carry aid promptly to those Christians. Now, notice, nowhere is the call for the launch of the Crusades talking about conquest. Nor is it talking about conversion. They were merely to remove Islamic invaders from lands that had been Christian to restore religious freedom to the whole lands. That's all that was being called for. So, what are the myths and the misconceptions that we need to deal with? The popular misconception about the Crusades were these were aggressive wars of expansion fought by religious fanatics in order to evict Muslims from their homelands and force conversions to Christianity. However, the truth is far different. Professor Jonathan Riley Smith of Oxford, who's written a lot of books on the Crusades, he's considered the foremost authority on the Crusades worldwide. Along with Professor Madden, they would constitute the two people who dedicate their entire professional life to studying the Crusades. And they both say these views are rubbish. No foundation whatsoever. Absolutely out of touch with reality. The Crusades were reactions to over 4 centuries of relentless Islamic jihad. That's the fact. And jihad had wiped out over 50% of all the Christians in the world and had conquered over 60% of the Christian lands on earth before the Crusades even began. So you can't blame the Crusaders. They didn't start it. They didn't draw first blood. Many of the towns liberated by the Crusaders were still over 90% Christian when the Crusaders arrived, proving these were Christian lands invaded by Muslim foreign invaders. Remember that the birthplace of the Christian church was the Middle East, or the place you want to read about. Saul of Tarsus on the road to Damascus, the 7 churches in Asia Minor, what today is Turkey, Jerusalem. These were the areas of the early church, which today are considered Muslim territory. It was the Christians who had been conquered and oppressed by the Seljuk Turks. So many of the towns in the Middle East welcomed the Crusaders as liberators. Far from being the aggressors, the Crusaders were not seen as the aggressors. It was the Muslim armies which had spread Islam from Saudi Arabia across the whole of the Christian North Africa into Spain and even France within the first century after the death of Muhammad, as we looked at with the Battle of Poitiers or Tours in France at 732. So you can see how the Saudi Arabians spread by the sword their religion within a century to the uttermost reaches of the world. Muslim armies sacked and slaughtered their way across some of the greatest Christian cities in the world, which included Alexandria, Carthage, Antioch, Constantinople, massacring the populations in each case. These Muslim invaders destroyed over 3,200 Christian churches just in the first 100 years of Islam alone. So as Professor Thomas Madden in The Real History of the Crusades points out, the Crusades in the East were in every way defensive wars. They were a direct response to Muslim aggression, an attempt to turn back or defeat, to defend against Muslim conquest of Christian lands. Christians in the 11th century were not paranoid fanatics. Not at all, because the Muslims really were gunning for them. They were under attack. The Muslims were doing hideous kinds of atrocities to Christians. Muslims really were targeting Christians. Islam was born in war, and Islam grew in war. From the time of Muhammad, the means of Muslim expansion was always by the sword. Christianity was the dominant religion of economic power and wealth. The Christian world, therefore, was a prime target for the earliest caliphs, and it would remain so for Muslim leaders for the next 1,000 years. Their target was the Christian world, because that's where there was a lot of loot and slaves. The Crusades were but a response to 5 centuries of conquest in which Muslims had already captured over 2/3 of the Christian world. Here you see Richard the Lionheart with his distinctive lion shield and his battle axe plowing into the midst of Muslim cavalry. This is how Richard fought. He went for the heaviest part of the enemy and he plowed in, and his knights were racing to try and catch up with him. What about thinking the unthinkable? The London Telegraph pointed out, a more realistic view of history requires less retrospective fantasy and more brain work. It means forcing your heads around to see what motivated men and women centuries ago. Try to think the unthinkable, that the Crusaders were right, and that we should be grateful to them. Now this is an editorial in England in the London Telegraph. Extraordinary. I don't think you're going to get that in the Cape Times or the Argus then. Professor Jonathan Riley Smith explains that crusading was an act of love for one's neighbour, an act of mercy to right a terrible wrong. Nobody involved in the crusades was thinking of themselves as violent aggressors. They saw themselves as making a sacrifice to show love for the Lord and love for their neighbour. As one church leader wrote to the Knights Templar, you carry out in deeds the words of the gospel, greater love than this has no man than that he lay down his life for his friend. For centuries, the word crusade and crusader were amongst the most hallowed and respected in Christendom. Many missions had the name crusade in their title. For example, C.T. Studd's mission was the Worldwide Evangelization Crusade. Over the years, they changed it to WEC, and recently they changed the initials to Worldwide Evangelization for Christ, because they're afraid that the word crusade could offend Muslims. Bill Baffin said that all through his early Christian work and walk, crusades were positive things. You were invited to have a crusade, to have an evangelistic crusade. And suddenly, somewhere along the line, it was a dirty word, and you're not allowed to use the word crusade anymore. People, the many schools that would have crusaders as the name of their sports team. And this was considered something positive. And your whole theme of your school might be a crusader emblem. And now there's an attempt to pull back from that because they're afraid of upsetting Muslims, which is absolutely ridiculous. Professor Jonathan Riley Smith points out that the goals of the Crusaders were, number one, to rescue the Christians of the East. Many thousands of Christians are bound in slavery and imprisoned by the Muslims and tortured with innumerable torments. This is quoting from contemporary materials. Secondly, their goal was the liberation of Jerusalem and other places made holy by the life of Christ. So the medieval Crusaders saw themselves as pilgrims, restoring to the Lord Jesus Christ his property. The Crusaders' conquest of Jerusalem was therefore not colonialism, but an act of restoration, an open declaration of one's love for God. This is Godfrey of Bouillon leading the Crusaders in the first breach of the walls. Incredible acts of courage in July 1099. Now it's often assumed that the central goal of the Crusades was forced conversion of the Muslim world, but nothing could be further from the truth. That wasn't the goal of the Crusaders. Although, let it be said, that there were people like Francis of Assisi who travelled to Egypt during the Third Crusade and who preached the gospel to the Sultan himself, to the leaders of the Muslims in Egypt. And there were Muslims who got converted and who were baptised as believers and welcomed into the church. So these things happened, but that was peripheral. That was not the central goal of the Crusades. Muslims did get converted during the Crusades. But the main goal of the Crusades was not to convert the Muslims, but to defeat them. From the perspective of medieval Christians, Muslims were the enemies of Christ and the enemies of his church. It was the crusaders' task to defeat them, to defend against them. That was all. Muslims who lived in crusader-won territories were generally allowed to retain their property, and they were always allowed to retain their religion. There's no example on record of crusaders forcing a Muslim to change his religion. Well, we've got innumerable tens of thousands of examples of Muslims forcing Christians to change their religion, but we can't find one example of a crusader forcing a Muslim to forsake his religion. They didn't try to persuade people by force, because they knew that you had to choose to be a Christian. It was no good to force it from the outside. When we think about the Middle Ages, we inevitably view Europe in the light of what it became, rather than what it was. The fact is, at that time, the military superpower of the medieval world was Islam, not Christianity. Christianity was stronger economically, but Islam was vastly stronger militarily at that time. The Crusades were a battle against all odds, with impossibly long lines of supply and cripplingly inadequate logistics. They were going spectacular distances, thousands of kilometers from home, because the Muslims didn't have far to go for their supply bases. It was a David against Goliath enterprise from the very beginning. The chance of success for the First Crusade was highly improbable. They had no leader, they had no chain of command, they had no supply lines, and they had no detailed strategy. The First Crusade consisted simply of thousands of dedicated warriors marching deep into enemy territory, thousands of kilometers from home. Many of them died of starvation, many of disease and wounds, even before they reached Jerusalem. It was a rough campaign that always was on the brink of disaster. Yet it was miraculously successful. By 1098, the Crusaders had liberated Nicaea and Antioch and restored it to Christian rule. And in July 1099, they liberated Jerusalem and began to rebuild a Christian state in Palestine, which lasted a century. You can't call that a failure. When Jerusalem fell to Saladin in 1187, Christians across Europe perceived that God was punishing them for their sins. And this led to numerous lay movements springing up throughout Europe, dedicated to purifying Christian society so it might become worthy of victory in the East. And Peter Waldo's Waldensians are just one such example of an inner purifying movement within the church as a result. Professor Madden of St. Louis University, the author of A Concise History of the Crusades, has observed, "From the safe distance of many centuries, it is easy enough to scowl in disgust at the Crusades. After all, religion is nothing to fight wars over." But we should be mindful, he said, that our medieval ancestors would have been equally disgusted by infinitely more destructive wars fought in the names of political ideologies. Just think of how millions were killed in the bombing of cities in Europe in this last century, in living memory. What did the Crusaders think of that? And there's a lot of people today who are so disgusted with the Crusaders going over and fighting for the honor of Christ in Jerusalem, and yet they don't seem to see our own guilt. What would they think of our societies? I know there's people today who say, "Oh, how could Christians in the Middle Ages and in the Reformation execute people for blasphemy?" Of course, it didn't have to happen often. In Calvin's Geneva, they only had to execute one person once for blasphemy, and it never had to happen again. What would they think if they looked at us and saw how blasphemy is allowed on national television and even in some school textbooks? What would they think of our tolerating communism and aiding it with billions and trillions of dollars of aid to keep vicious governments like the Red Chinese in power? All that was done to help even the massacre of Christians in Rwanda, which, let's face it, countries like France supported the genocidal lunatics of the MRND, who slaughtered 800,000 Christians in the space of just 6 weeks with machetes alone in 1994. So, let's not get on our high horses judging the Crusaders. Whether we admire the Crusaders or not, it's a fact that the world we know today would not exist without their efforts. You can say that for sure. The ancient faith of Christianity, with its respect for women and its antipathy against slavery, not only survived, but flourished. And without the Crusades, it might have followed Zoroastrianism, another of Islam's rivals, into extinction. But for the Crusades, Europe might have fallen to Islam, and the United States and South Africa would certainly not have come to existence. There would not be countries like New Zealand, Australia, Canada, South Africa in the world today if it had not been for the Crusades. That is without a question. Because if it wasn't for the Crusades, there wouldn't have been a Europe. There would have just been a Eurabia. Now, we need to learn to discern. There's not many films out there on the Crusades today, and any that come out these days are against the Crusades. For example, Kingdom of Heaven. Dr. Ted Baer of Movie Guide warns viewers that media-wise viewers need to reject revisionist history such as that shown in the Kingdom of Heaven. The problem is that future generations could accept this politically correct anti-Christian propaganda as fact. And so let me give some attention to Kingdom of Heaven, because it's probably the biggest epic film made in our lifetimes on the Crusades, and it's got everything wrong. Ridley Scott's blockbuster epic Kingdom of Heaven presents one of the worst distortions of history seen on the screen in any recent years. Focusing obviously on the fall of Jerusalem in 1187, not on the liberation of Jerusalem in 1099 by the Christians, this is the fall of Jerusalem to the Muslims. This anti-Christian politically correct revisionism gets everything wrong. First of all, Scott's Kingdom of Heaven has its geography very wrong. We know that the film was shot in Spain and Morocco, and it shows. Most people should know that Jerusalem is not in the middle of the Sahara Desert, yet in this film, Jerusalem's high walls are surrounded by sand dunes, without a tree, bush, or blade of grass in sight. The Mount of Olives, nowhere to be seen. Kidron Valley, Valley of Hinnom, nowhere to be seen. Now, who here has been to Jerusalem? Helga has? You have? Now, you have noticed, it's not a nice tarmac ramp up to the walls of Jerusalem, is it?
No.
It's mountainous, it's hilly, it's uneven ground. It was built there specifically for protection from attack. And yet,
yes, in fact, they do. Jerusalem has some beautiful garden areas, not just the Garden of Gethsemane, but they do have a few, the few others with green grass and everything. Although, however, there is a lot of digits. But
the point is here, you can bring your siege engines right up to the wall comfortably because there's absolutely no valleys around it. So this film is unbelievably, I mean, it's to think they could just do a geography like that, it's like depicting Cape Town without Table Mountain and the ocean. It's insane. Unlike the Crusaders who liberated Jerusalem in 1099, Saladin's army's got no problem moving his siege engines and assault towers right up to the walls of Jerusalem, because Scott's Jerusalem in the Kingdom of Heaven is not surrounded by any valleys or ditches, conveniently. This film also boldly asserts that Messina was a seaport to the Holy Land. Begging pardon. Now, Messina is on the island of Sicily. So you wonder how French crusaders could or would depart from Sicily. They've got to actually leave Europe before they get to the island, surely. Genoa, Venice, Naples, they were the ports that the sailors who took the crusaders sailed from. Now, Kingdom of Heaven distorts history beyond all recognition. The 100-year truce between the Christian and Muslim armies is a figment of their imagination. There was no 100-year truce. The warfare throughout the 12th century was incessant. The depiction of the Knights Templar as a band of religious fanatics trying to shatter the truce and provoke war with the Muslims by attacking caravans is total fabrication. No Knights Templar ever attacked any caravans. Attacking caravans is what the founder of Islam, Muhammad, and his caliphs regularly did. The Knights Templar and the Knights of St. John were formed primarily to protect travellers from attacks by the Muslim army. Professors Madden and Riley Smith have both said they can say with confidence no caravans were ever attacked by Knights Templar, not once, ever. It's absolute rubbish. And yet, in the Storm Kingdom of Heaven, the Muslims are the victims and the Knights Templar are the ones attacking the caravans. In fact, it was the slaughter of Christian pilgrims by Muslim armies in violation of earlier agreements of safe passage that precipitated the Crusades in the first place. This is calling the pot calling the kettle black and calling sweet bits and bittersweet and light darkness and darkness light. The central figure of the Kingdom of Heaven film, Sir Balian, is a historical figure, amazingly. He did, in fact, play a critical role in the defense of Jerusalem in 1187. But the film script distorts his character and his role beyond all recognition. First of all, Balian was not a blacksmith, nor was he living in France, nor did his wife commit suicide, nor was he illegitimate, nor was he raised as a commoner. So all the basic premises are rubbish. His father, Balian Old, not Godfrey as in the movie, they obviously thought couldn't handle having father and son both having the same name of Balian. That's too confusing for the idiots who've watched this film. So they changed his name to Godfrey. He had three sons and they're all legitimate. No illegitimate children. There's Hugh, Baldwin and Balian. Balian the youngest. Balian never had to travel to the Holy Land because he was born and brought up there. He is part of the nobility in the Holy Land. Balian was married to royalty long before the events portrayed in the film, and he wasn't at all romantically involved with Princess Sibylla, so that wipes out the next part of the film. In Kingdom of Heaven, Balian is portrayed as questioning whether God exists, although according to the historical records it's clear Balian was a dedicated Christian and he took his faith very seriously. Nor did Balian desert the defence of the Holy Land following the fall of Jerusalem. He didn't return to France. The film ends with Richard the Lionheart trying to recruit him and him not wanting to go back to the Holy Land while he carries on being a blacksmith in France. A lot of rubbish. Balian never went to France. He proceeded to Beirut in Lebanon. He helped to fortify it against Muslim invasion. He was part of the Third Crusade fighting along with Richard the Lionheart, and he was at the signing of the peace with Saladin when Saladin had to concede safe passage for Christian pilgrims and recognizing Crusader control over the 90-mile stretch of coastline from Tyre to Jaffa. According to Kingdom of Heaven, the real hero in the story is the famous Muslim general Saladin. Now, although Saladin was an exceptionally gifted military strategist and he is unusually chivalrous, the film has uncritically accepted and embellished all the legends about Saladin beyond what any historical record could accept. For example, the real facts are Saladin was a Muslim Kurd from northern Iraq. He was raised in a privileged family. He is very ambitious. At age 14, he joined his uncle's military staff, and at 31, he followed him to Egypt, where his uncle was Grand Vizier. Now, his uncle died violently 2 months later, and Saladin seized power, so there's a strong possibility he was behind it. And he defeated competing Muslim leaders and started a dynasty which established Egypt as the major Muslim power in the Middle East for centuries. Far from having war forced upon him, as the film depicts, the film has the Crusaders raping his sister, which is total garbage. Never happened. Rubbish. And so this kind of emotive thing puts Saladin as the aggrieved, reluctant warrior forced into war. Saladin initiated the conflict. He declared a jihad against the Christians. He swept through Palestine, well-organized, well-prepared. He captured more than 50 Crusader castles in 2 years. This is not the reluctant warrior forced into conflict defensively. At the Battle of Hattin on the 4th of July, 1187, Saladin's army defeated the Christians on the shores of Lake Tiberias. That's Sea of Galilee. Now in the film, this battle is depicted in a waterless desert. Far from being the magnanimous victor depicted in the modern legends and in this film, Saladin was a ruthless general who had thousands of Christian soldiers beheaded in cold blood, including after the Battle of Hattin, where he had every one of the knights beheaded. Now, that's the fact, and that's the ugly reality. But in the film, Saladin's portrayed as being most gracious in allowing the defenders of Jerusalem safe passage. In fact, after the negotiated surrender of Jerusalem, when they just didn't have enough food or anything else to survive, the Patriarch of Jerusalem initiates this, and Saladin demands that every man, woman, and child in Jerusalem pay a ransom for his or her freedom, or face the grim prospect of Islamic slavery. In order to save the lives and liberty of the poor people who couldn't afford the heavy ransom that was demanded by Saladin, Balian paid out of his own resources the ransoms required by those who could not afford it. Now the theology in Kingdom of Heaven is all wrong. The film depicts a monk standing at the roadside repeating, "To kill an infidel is not murder, it's a pathway to heaven." Now, as any student of the Bible should be able to tell you, neither that concept nor those words appear anywhere in the Christian Bible. But any student of the Quran should be able to tell you that's exactly what the Islamic doctrine of jihad teaches. It's no sin to kill an infidel, it's a pathway to heaven. That's Islam, it's not Christianity. At one point early in the film, as Muslims bow in prayer towards Mecca, Balian comments, "You allow them to pray?" And a knight sneers and says, "As long as they pay their taxes." In fact, Crusaders never required any extra tax of Muslims in order to allow them to pray. That's the Islamic doctrine practice of jaza. To this day, Muslim governments require jaza, tribute taxes, of dhimmis, that's Jews and Christians, under Islamic rule. Before the Crusaders march out to the disastrous Battle of Hattin, the film has one knight declaring, "The army of Jesus Christ cannot be beaten." Why did they put that in the film? No Christian said that or believed that. There's no such doctrine in the Bible. There's no such concept in Christian theology. It's in fact Islamic doctrine and dogma that no Muslim army can ever be defeated by an infidel army. This Muhammad asserted on the authority of Allah himself, something which the recent defeats of the Taliban in Afghanistan and Saddam Hussein's military superpower in the Middle East, Iraq, by the Americans, this has precipitated a serious theological problem for Islamic scholars. How can their Muslim armies be defeated by infidel armies? It's a theological impossibility, according to Islam. But we can give you a lot of examples when Muslims have been defeated in battle. Lepanto, Great Siege of Malta, Battle of Tours, Poitiers, Siege of Vienna, and we'll look at all of those. And this is a problem, just like Muhammad saying that he cut the moon in half with a sword, and rubbish like this. You can't take anything Muhammad says seriously. Quite aside from the factual errors in geography, the attributing of Islamic doctrine to Christians, the blatant distortion of history, the kingdom of heaven is an insult to the intelligence of its viewers in terms of its absolutely preposterous script. Here we expect to believe that Balian is grieving his wife's death, but he doesn't even attend to her burial. That Balian reigns the commoner, he's trained only as a blacksmith and he's from France, yet arriving at the Holy Land, he could be teaching the local people how to practice agriculture and dig wells in the desert, and that this blacksmith, with no military training, could know more about siege weapons and military strategy than all the knights and military professionals concentrated in the Holy Land put together. Just where would a blacksmith have learned about siege engines and trabuckets and cavalry tactics and defensive strategy? By the way, actual maximum range for a 12th century catapult would have been 150 meters with a 300-pound or a 300-pound rock. That would be it. So 150-kilogram rock, 150 meters. That's maximum. Remember, that's rope, not steel titanium cables. And yet in this film, they have unbelievable traveling kilometer or so, tons, destroying into powder the stone walls of Jerusalem. It's just ludicrous, isn't it? CGI guys had a lot of fun, but how can anyone take this seriously? How can any viewer with a grasp of history or military strategy swallow the kind of drivel and tactics dished up in films like Kingdom of Heaven? What soldiers throw their shields away and their helmet away just before engaging a massive assault by the enemy? That's what you've just carried it 3,000 kilometers for. Why would you throw it away at the moment that you need it? Now, apparently Orlando Bloom wanted his long flowing locks to flow in the breeze, but seriously, what knight throws his helmet away just before engaging in hand-to-hand combat? Or people are wanting to split your head open with an axe? And as any student of history or anthropology should be able to tell you, the Crusaders did not burn the bodies of their dead. That was the practice of the Vikings, the ancient Greeks, the Hindus, but not the Christians. Christians buried their dead. They didn't burn their dead. But in this film, the Christians burn their dead while the Muslims bury their dead. And the ridiculous speech with its feel good, why can't we all just get along together, drivel, dished up Orlando Bloom's Balian on the walls of Jerusalem while Saladin's armies politely wait for him to finish this stupid speech. No, honestly. But it may sound believable to some 21st century humanists, but those were not the convictions or the sentiments of any 12th century crusader. As for the pathetic egalitarian gesture of knighting everybody in Jerusalem, without any training, testing, code of conduct, unthinkable, unhistorical, so out of touch with reality, what drugs were the script trying to on? And the ridiculous inane comments attributed to the bishop in the film are not only highly unlikely, jarringly anachronistic, but producer Ridley Scott and scriptwriter William Monaghan obviously hates Christianity. And that's the main purpose of the whole film, just to show the hate for Christianity. Just in case any of you lack the discernment to detect the unveiled anti-Christian prejudice and hostility which permeates the entire film, Ridley Scott went on record saying, "Balian's an agnostic, just like me." Well, he might be an agnostic, but Balian was not. Of course, there was no such thing as agnosticism in the 12th century, especially not amongst the Crusaders. The word agnostic was a 19th century invention. It didn't exist before. Considering how few people today read history books, and how most depend almost entirely on this kind of based on a true story. The names and the places are true, only the facts have been changed to protect the guilty. And yet this is the main way that people understand history. This kind of blind prejudice and obsessive hatred against Christianity on the part of producers and directors should be frightening. As Karl Marx declared, the first battlefield is the rewriting of history. Which is why we give so much attention to history in the Reformation Society, because everything Christian is under attack in Hollywood and in school textbooks. I'm sure the enemies of Christianity are delighted with propaganda pics like Kingdom of Heaven. Now, this classic version of the Crusades, as depicted in this $150 million Kingdom of Heaven epic, was produced in consultation with groups such as the Council on American Islamic Relations. You can be sure they didn't consult with Movie Guide or the Christian Film Television Commission. Professor Jonathan Riley Smith, author of A Short History of the Crusades, describes the film as rubbish. It's not historically accurate at all. It depicts Muslims as sophisticated and civilized, and the Crusaders are all brutes and barbarians. It has nothing to do with reality. In fact, in the film, the Crusaders are all dirty, unshaven, unwashed thugs, and the Muslims are neat, clean, with neatly ironed and absolutely blow-dried, perfectly dry, cleaned robes and jalabas. You wondered why the Crusaders didn't send their washing to the same laundromat. Because, you know, honestly, the Muslims are just so clean and neat, and the Christians are so sloppy. The fact is, the Crusades of the Middle Ages were a reaction to centuries of Islamic jihad. In the first century of Islam alone, the Muslim invaders had conquered the whole of the previously Christian North Africa, destroying 3,200 churches in just 100 years. And they kidnapped Christians, they killed Christians, kidnapped their children, raised them as Muslims, compelled people to convert at the point of the sword. More than half of all the Christians on the planet were wiped out during the first three centuries of Islamic rule. The Saracens, as these Muslim invaders were called, desecrated Christian places of worship and severely persecuted Christians. Pilgrims were then prevented from visiting those places where our Lord was born, where he was crucified, where he was raised from the dead. It was only after five centuries of Islamic jihad that the Crusades were launched as a belated reaction to the Islamic jihad. As the Christian History Institute pointed out, the characterizing of Crusaders as only in it for the plunder and loot betrays an ignorance of both geography and history. The vast majority of Crusaders were impoverished and financially ruined by the Crusades. They tried to suggest in recent rewriting of history that the Crusaders were people who didn't have land and they were basically just needing to go and steal someone else's land and get some loot, which is nonsense. Often it was the oldest in the family, it was the firstborn, who sacrificed his lands, who sacrificed his title, who sacrificed everything, who impoverished themselves often. And most of them, of course, died in these Crusades. Very few came back. Crusaders, through great sacrifice and personal expense, left their homes and their families to travel 3,000 kilometers across treacherous and inhospitable terrain, and the shortest crusade lasted 4 years. You just look at the distances they had to travel. Spectacular distances. And there were no purified water bottles on the way, and no nice restaurants on the way, no new nice hotels. Forget the Coca-Cola, etc. I mean, this was a rough, not even roads or bridges in many cases. And here you can see the distances people travelled. You can see the Latin empires, meaning Roman Catholic mostly, the Byzantine and Eastern Orthodox, and then where the Muslims controlled. And you can see how the Christians came through and established first crusade, they came overland, second crusade, they started using the sea as well, and so you can see the different waves. Considering that only 10% of the Crusaders had horses, 90% were foot soldiers, the sheer fact of the logistics that the Crusaders could not have possibly carried back enough loot to have made up for their loss of earnings, high expenses involved in the long Crusades. If you have ever walked on a hike for a day, you know you don't want to carry more than you have to. And when you know you've got to carry food and water just to survive, and you're walking in the desert, how much loot do you think you can carry? I mean, realistically, and if you know you're going to walk for 100 days, you've got 3,000 kilometers to walk, what loot could possibly be worth it? They couldn't exactly UPS it, put on a railway or ship it home or something. They had to carry it. And many crusaders lost their homes and their farms to finance their involvement in the crusades. This is the case of one crusader, Malian, who took on the entire Muslim army, and plainly you can see how many arrows in himself and his horse. He just kept fighting to the end. People like that don't do it for the loot and the plunder. There's something else that's motivating them. Main point, there's more to life than money. Not everyone does things for money. I know many people find this hard to believe. But perhaps self-seeking materialistic agnostics in the 21st century cannot understand that some people could be motivated by something other than financial enrichment. But the fact is, many people make sacrifices. Communists do, Muslims do, and Christians do, in order to help others for religious convictions. In the case of the Crusaders, the historical record makes clear that amongst the motivations that led tens of thousands of volunteers to reclaim the Holy Land, one of the motivations was a sense of religious duty. To help the fellow Christians in the East, whose lands had been invaded, whose church had been desecrated by Muslim armies, and there was the desire to secure access to the Holy Lands for pilgrims. There was also the desire to fight for the honour of their Lord, the Lord Jesus Christ, whose churches had been destroyed, whose deity had been denied by Mohammedan aggressors. In other words, to the Crusaders, this was a defensive war to reclaim Christian lands from Muslim invaders. Now, we may not share their convictions, we may not agree with all their methods, but we should evaluate them in the light of the realities of the 11th and 12th centuries, not anachronistically project our standards and politics back upon them. The scriptwriters of the film Kingdom of Heaven and director Ridley Scott, obviously they don't understand the motivations behind the Crusaders. They apparently don't understand the Islamic doctrine of jihad either. The film makes no reference to jihad. Considering that jihad was the central threat that had led to the reaction of the Crusades, this omission is inexplicable and inexcusable. Kingdom of Heaven preoccupies itself with fictionalizing Crusader atrocities, but it ignores the pattern of the preceding 5 centuries of genocide and aggression by Islamic armies. Ridley Scott's Kingdom of Heaven is politically correct, anti-Christian, pro-Muslim propaganda. It makes poor entertainment and it's worthless distortion of reality. And because it's the most prominent source of information about the Crusades around today, that's why I've given so much time and attention to dismantling it. There's a lot more I could say, such as armor does not float. And yet somehow in the storm, everyone else sinks and there's only one survivor of the storm, and that's Balian, and his horse is the only surviving horse, and he wakes up on the shore in his armor with a sword and shield and helmet next to him. Isn't that convenient? How does that happen? That the ship sinks, everywhere hand is lost, but only his armor, horse and sword end up on the side. I mean, armor doesn't float to sink. It doesn't float, it sinks. Now, for those wanting the politically incorrect rest of the story on Kingdom of Heaven, which the film does not even hint to, that's why we wrote Slavery, Terrorism and Islam. Now, in Ted Baer's article, Self-Hate, Revisionist History and Christophobia in the movie Kingdom of Heaven, he notes some of the differences between Muhammad and Christ. Muhammad was the prophet of war. Christ is the prince of peace. Muhammad's disciples killed for their faith. Christ's disciples were killed for their faith. Muhammad promoted persecution against the infidels. Christ forgave and converted the chief persecutor, Paul. Muhammad was the taker of life. Christ is the giver of life. Muhammad and his fellow warriors murdered thousands. Christ murdered nobody, but he saved many. Muhammad's method was compulsion. Christ's aim is conversion. Muhammad practiced force. Christ preached faith. Muhammad was a warrior. Christ is a deliverer. Muhammad said to the masses, convert or die. Christ said, believe and live. Muhammad was swift to shed blood. Christ shed his own blood for the salvation of many. Muhammad preached death to the infidels. Christ prayed, Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do. Muhammad declared a holy war, jihad, against infidels. Christ achieved a holy victory on Calvary's cross. His followers share in that victory. Muhammad constrained people by conquest. Christ constrained people by love. Modern terrorists derive their inspiration from Muhammad and carry out their despicable atrocities in the name of their God, Allah. Christians derive their inspiration from the one who said, blessed are the peacemakers. Modern day disciples of Muhammad respond to terrorist attacks by cheering in the streets, but modern day disciples of Christ are deeply grieved at past atrocities carried out by those who are Christians in name only. And he puts here the Crusades and the Spanish Inquisition. I think the Crusades don't belong in that list, but I'm just quoting from Ted Gray's article here. So one footnote, don't agree with that comment there. Many Muslims are peaceful and peace-loving because they do not strictly follow the teachings of their founder, Muhammad. But some Christians are not peaceful and peace-loving because they do not strictly follow the teachings of their founder. So if you're violent today and a Muslim, you might be more consistent with the teaching and example of Muhammad. If you are a terrorist and you claim to be a Christian, you've violated every teaching of Christ, the example of Christ, the teaching of the church. And so if a so-called Christian commits acts of terrorism in the name of Christianity, which I don't know that anyone's ever tried to do, he would be in violation of the laws of Christ and of the church. But if a Muslim does it, he might be more consistent as a Muslim. So a Muslim who's peace-loving might be the inconsistent one. Muhammad called upon his servants to fight. Jesus said, my kingdom is not of this world. If my kingdom was of this world, then would my servants fight. But now is my kingdom not from here. Muhammad ordered death to the Jews. Christ ordered that the gospel be preached to the Jew first. The Quran says, fight and slay the pagans wherever you find them. Christ said, preach the gospel to every creature. Muhammad's mission was to conquer the world for Allah. Christ's mission is to conquer sin's penalty and power by substitutionary atonement. Muhammad claimed that there was but one God, Allah. Christ claimed that he himself was God. Muhammad's tomb is occupied. Christ's tomb is empty. Jesus Christ is risen. He is alive today. So, this is my poem that I've put together to compare. Jesus healed the sick. Muhammad healed no one. Jesus could make the blind see. Muhammad could only make the seeing blind. Jesus could make a crippled man walk, but Muhammad could just make the walking crippled. Jesus could take a dead man and make him alive. Muhammad could take a live man and make him dead. Jesus could multiply food to feed thousands. Muhammad could divide the loot amongst his followers. He could steal from thousands and divide the loot amongst his people. Jesus could walk on the water. Muhammad could just ride a camel. Islam is a religion of hatred and slavery based upon a lie. Christianity is a relationship of love with God based upon the truth. The word crusade does not appear anywhere in the Bible. It's not commanded in Christianity. But jihad is the sixth pillar of Islam, and it's the second greatest command of Muhammad. It's not only commended, it's commanded in the Quran. Jihad, the subjugation, the forcible conversion of all people to Islam, and world domination are in fact central tenets of Islam. Jihad is the sixth pillar of Islam. Jihad was so important to Muhammad that he declared it to be the second most important deed in Islam. Allah's apostle was asked, what is the best deed? He replied, to believe in Allah and in his apostle. The questioner then asked, what is the second in goodness? He replied, to participate in jihad in Allah's cause. Now, of course, let's try and be fair and say most Muslims are neither terrorists nor terrorist sympathizers. While many Muslims publicly rejoiced over the news of the horrific terrorist attacks on New York and Washington, D.C., most did not. We need to be careful not to blame all Muslims for what certain Muslim individuals do in the name of Islam. But, of course, those peace-loving, law-abiding Muslims are not actually being consistent with the jihad teachings of the Quran. Good thing they're not either. They're probably more influenced by the Christian ideal of loving a neighbor than the Islamic doctrine of jihad, because many are in Christian communities. Some of them might have picked up Christian ways of behavior, but it didn't come from Islam. In fact, Muslims can be allies of Christians in our campaigns against gambling, pornography, homosexuality, abortion, evolutionism, and atheism. Muslims and Christians agree that God is the creator and the eternal judge of the whole world and everything in it. But it's important for us to recognize the Quranic roots, which are quoted by Muslim terrorists, to support their atrocities. If this violent position does not represent mainstream Islam, Muslim leaders must clearly denounce the literal application of these jihad verses, and there's over 100 of them. And they must declare apostate all Muslims who resort to terrorism as murderers destined to an eternity in hell. I've got no problem damning to hell any so-called Christian who commits these sort of acts of terrorism and says he doesn't name Christianity. I will say he's no Christian. As Christ says, whoever hates his brother is a murderer, there's no life in him, and so that is quite straightforward. Murderers cannot be believers. I've got that on the authority of scripture. I will condemn them without a hesitation anyway. But where's the imam who will condemn these terrorists as apostates doomed to hell? Surah 5:36. Those who resist Islam, execution or mutilation is decreed. The punishment of those who wage war against Allah and his apostle and strive with might and main for mischief throughout the land is execution or crucifixion, or the cutting of the hands and feet from opposite sides and exile from the land. Islam instructs its adherents to fight until all their opponents submit. Christians and Jews can only be spared if they pay jizah, penalty tax, with willing submission. Fight those who believe not in God nor the last day, nor acknowledge the religion of truth, even if they are the people of the book, until they pay jizah, tribute taxes, with willing submission, and feel themselves subdued, in other words, humiliated. Fight and slay the pagans wherever you find them and seize them, it's enslave them, beleaguer them, lie in wait and ambush them, in every stratagem or deception of war. Surah 9:5. Therefore, when you meet with unbelievers, smite at the necks, chop the heads off. And when you have thoroughly subdued them, bind a bond firmly on them, enslave them. Thereafter is the time for either generosity or ransom. Kidnap them, hold them for ransom. Until the war lays down its burden, thus you are commanded. That's Surah 47:4. Islam divides the whole world into two, Dar al-Islam, the house of Islam, and Dar al-Harab, the house of war. The only countries considered to be at peace are those countries where Islamic law, Sharia, is enforced. All other countries, as part of Dar al-Harab, are considered legitimate military targets. Fight them until there is no more tumult or oppression, there prevails justice and faith in Allah altogether and everywhere. Now there is the jihad of words, using oratory in a war of nerves to inspire their own side to undermine the morale of the enemy. Every Friday, the mosques have these kind of messages. There's the jihad of deception to confuse the enemy. Islam is not requiring its adherents to tell the truth. That's why to swear to tell the truth or to swear to uphold the constitution with your hand on a Quran is meaningless. You might as well do it on a stack of pornography, honestly and truly. There's nothing in the Quran that requires you to tell the truth. So what's the point? The reason why people swear in the Bible is because the Bible's got the most severe penalties for perjury. In capital punishment cases, capital punishment, if you give perjury. So swearing on the Bible to tell the truth means something. Swearing in the Quran is as meaningless as swearing on Das Kapital. There is the jihad of the sword, to kill the enemy, to loot his possessions, and to take hostages for ransom. Jihad is one of the chief meritorious acts in the eyes of Islam, and it's the best source of earnings, says the Mishkat. The jihad of taxation on non-Muslims and financial reward to provide incentives to converts to Islam, all this is part of jihad. And then there's the jihad of Sharia law, which degrades non-Muslims to a lower status, denies them access to the law because their testimony is not valid against a Muslim. No non-Muslim's testimony is valid against a Muslim, no woman's testimony is valid against a man. That's Sharia law. There's also the jihad of polygamy, which is designed to give Muslims a disproportionate numerical advantage through having up to four wives at a time. There's also the jihad of the spirits, whatever that means. Millions of Christians have been slaughtered throughout the centuries by Islamic militants. This isn't just some academic talk. There's people who take this seriously. In 1915, 1.5 million Christian Armenians were murdered in Turkey. Christians have continued to be slaughtered by Islamic militants in Indonesia. Teenage girls beheaded. Christians murdered in the Philippines. Sudan and Nigeria have had massacres and atrocities to this very day perpetrated by the Muslims who have destroyed hundreds of churches. To this day, Muslims are continuing the holy war against Christians in Sudan and throughout the Middle East. And we could mention Smyrna, the destruction of the last Christian city in Asia, 300,000 people destroyed in 1922, which is in living memory of some people we know. The destruction of a city, Smyrna, 1922. And we've experienced and documented atrocities in our own ministry as well. Therefore, before Christians fall all over themselves to apologize for the Crusades, which ended over 700 years ago, it would be wise to first learn from reliable sources what the Crusades were all about and study the Islamic teachings and track record of jihad over the last 14 centuries. Because you didn't take part in the Crusades, your grandfather didn't take part in the Crusades. Why should you be apologizing for the Crusades? Which Muslim has ever apologized for jihad? Which Muslim has apologized for the destruction they've done in our lifetime, which is inconveniencing all of us when we travel by air? Those who don't know their past have no future. So what should our response be to terrorist attacks and ongoing jihad against so many Christians worldwide? First, we need to recognize that this terrorism and anti-Christian persecution is originating from the least evangelized area of the world, the Middle East. The birthplace of the church is now the most needy mission field on earth. We have a unique opportunity in this time of crisis to effectively proclaim the gospel to Muslims all over the world. Instead of reacting out of malice or anger, let us seek God's grace to reach out to Muslim neighbors in Christian love. If we were evangelizing Muslims in our schools and in our communities and in our place of work, they would not be coming in the numbers that are. They'd either be getting converted or they would be being pulled out because the Muslims don't want to lose their people. But they can infiltrate and swamp our neighborhoods and our schools because the Christians are generally not even evangelizing them. So it's no risk for them. This is the time when we can openly and politely discuss the differences between the gospel and the example of Christ and the teachings and actions of Muhammad. We can share in personal testimony and challenge Muslims to consider the claims of Christ. Our duty in the Christian church is to be a ministry of grace. We need to be a house of prayer for all nations, and there's over 50 nations in the world, 57 that are Muslim countries. We need to preach repentance and forgiveness of sins to all nations, making disciples of all nations, including Libya and Saudi Arabia, and teaching obedience to all things that the Lord has commanded. Now, by God's grace, Frontline Fellowship has already distributed over 300,000 Bibles and Christian books, a lot of it in Arabic, throughout southern Sudan and Nubian Mountains, and we need to do a lot more in the future. Question: were the Crusades a failure? The constant depictions of the Crusades as a failure is not justified by the historical record. The Crusades succeeded in seizing the initiative, throwing the Muslim invaders onto the defensive. For the first time after five centuries of attack, the Crusaders bought Europe time. They bought Europe centuries. At a critical time, the Crusades united and divided Europe and threw the Muslim invaders back, bringing a peace and a security to Europe that had not been known for centuries. As a result of the tremendous sacrifice of the Crusades, Christian Europe experienced spiritual revival and biblical reformation. And this inspired a great resurgence of learning, scientific experimentation, technological advancement, movements that led to the greatest prosperity and freedoms that has ever been known in all of history. For a picture of what Europe might be like today had Islam succeeded in conquering it, you only need look at the previously Christian civilizations of Egypt and what today is called Turkey. The Copts in Egypt now make up just 10% of the total Egyptian population and are severely persecuted. That's what Europe could be looking like today if there had not been a crusade. What is today called Turkey was once a vibrant Christian Byzantine empire, economic military superpower of its day. Today the Christian civilization which flourished there for 1,000 years has all but been extinguished. The last Christian city in Asia, Smyrna, massacred by the Turkish army, 1922. Without the Crusades, it's questionable whether Europe, South Africa or America would even exist. The Crusades ended over 700 years ago. Islamic jihad continues today. Psalm 72:9-11 says, "The desert tribes will bow down to him. His enemies will lick the dust. All kings will bow down to him, and all nations will serve him." So our Patriot missile to bring down the scuds of Islam is slavery, terrorism, and Islam, historical roots and contemporary threat. And the best DVD to alert people to the reality of Islam is Islam Rising. 4-part series, outstanding. Ex-Muslims, ex-Muslim terrorists, many people to give the other side of what's going on in Islam. We've helped produce a lot of our own material and taken on Jeremiah Films to produce these 2 films on Saddam, terrorism persecution, and Saddam, the hidden Holocaust. Of course, it's so important people understand what's going on in the Middle East. We've got CDs and that, and on some of the great victories against Islam to inspire people that can be done, to understand the challenge of Islam, women in Islam, what the reformers taught in Islam, the end of Islam, comparing the Bible with the Quran. All of this and more are in our Muslim Evangelism Workshop MP3, and these are some of the resources, audiovisual materials we're providing. Also, there's an excellent film called More Than Dreams, which is without copyright. We can make as many copies, distribute them as widely as we can. They are specifically designed to lend to Muslims or give to Muslims, because it's 5 testimonies of Muslims from different backgrounds, recreation, reenactments, dramas, but all factual on people who were Muslim converted to Christ. Excellent film to show to Muslims. Our books, these posters, Prayer Post, Pray for the Muslim World, are on our website. Of course, we've got a mobilized serious prayer. On the Frontline website, you'll find a lot of material dealing with Islam and how we can combat it. So, you'll also find some Christian Action magazines that have dealt with the scourge of slavery or guilt manipulation, which are all part of the kind of battles that we're dealing with. And of course, many Frontline users deal with Islam and the persecution church there.